From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. New York Times columnist Tom Friedman says the stakes are just getting higher on a real American rebound. Prepare the comeback, he says, or it's more than our economy at stake. It's our basic values in a world that could go in very different directions. You want a solution, says Friedman, a game changer? Bring on a carbon tax on oil, gas, coal. Balance the books, save the planet, change everything. This hour on Point, Tom Friedman and his Hail Mary, his silver bullet, the carbon tax. You can join us on air or online where this conversation never ends. Are you ready to pay a bit more for your carbon-based energy to save everything? Do we do big solutions anymore? Is this a big solution? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me now from Washington is Thomas Friedman, Pulitzer Prize-winning columnist for The New York Times, author of the new expanded edition of his 1989 bestseller From Beirut to Jerusalem. His big op-ed essay, How to Put America Back Together Again, got our attention. You can link to it at our website, onpointradio.org. Tom Friedman, welcome back to On Point.
Tom, thanks. Great to be with you. And I want to say I listened to you guys during the Boston Marathon crisis, and you're just great. So it's great to be with you.
Thank you. We're glad to be making our way through that, and I appreciate that. Listen, it seems like every time we speak with you, and it's maybe once a year or maybe not that often, but every time it seems like your level of alarm has risen again. And this piece, which was just, a few days ago in the Times, saying, look, you want American pluralism and tolerance to be the goal? You've got to be a strong country, and that fundamental idea of America as a strong country in this world is really in trouble, and we've got to do something. We'll get to your solution, but let's just start with the big picture. The stakes here, Tom, for an American comeback.
Well, Tom, last time we were on, it was to talk actually about the latest book, which I wrote with Michael Mandelbaum, That Used to Be Us, How America Lost Its Way and the World It Invented and How We Can Come Back. And so this issue has been on my mind for a long time.
Yeah.
You know, the simple argument of that book is that America, we make all mistakes in the world, and they're too long to catalog on any given show. But on balance, we believe, my co-author and I, that America provides a huge number of global public goods, whether it's, you know, keeping the sea lanes open in the Pacific or promoting world trade or the World Bank, AIDS, drugs in Africa. You can go down that list as well. And we also provide something else, and we think this is vitally important. That's an example of a pluralistic, modernizing democratic society where people from all over the world come together and build a thriving society. And we believe that if America goes weak, you're weak economically, Tom, your kids won't just grow up in a different America. They'll grow up in a fundamentally different world, a world ordered by Russia or by China or most likely by nobody at all. And I don't think that's a good thing. And really, my whole argument for, you know, why we need to strengthen our system is because it is a huge example, a powerful and important example of people of different cultures, faiths, ethnicities, all living together in a forward-leaning society. And that's really where I'm coming from.
You tied it right back to last week's bombings in Boston. You said, look, we don't fully understand what went on with these two young brothers, what may have gone on there yet. But you wrote, we need to redouble our efforts to make America stronger and healthier so it remains a vibrant counterexample to whatever bigoted ideology may have gripped these young men. What's happening to that example now? How does it relate to the economy? How does it relate to carbon-based fuel?
Well, basically, it really goes back to what we think the solution is for America right now. And we believe it is, call it a grand bargain, call it a small bargain, call it a broad understanding. We need to do three things, Tom, right now. First, we need to cut some things because we've made promises to the next generation we cannot possibly keep. Second, we need to raise taxes because we can't just cut things. If all you do is cut, look, as I said in that column, if I want to lose weight really quickly, I can cut off both thumbs. But that might make it a little hard for me to get my next job. That's what the sequester is, in effect. Mm. So we can't just cut. We have to tax. We need to raise more revenue because we also need to invest. We need to invest in the sources of our strength. So let's stop for a second. What are those? How do we get here? How do we become the world's most wealthy country, the place where more people want to come and live? It's because we had, I believe, the greatest public-private partnership in the history of the world. That is, we had a public side that really enabled and unleashed enormous amount of private energy, talent, and capital. What was that public side? It was built on five pillars. First, we educated our people up to and beyond whatever the technology was. So when it was the cotton gin, universal primary education. When it was the factory, universal secondary education. And when it's the computer and the supercomputer, it's got to be universal post-secondary education. Second, we had the best infrastructure, roads, airports, telecom, bandwidth. Third, we had the most government-funded research that invested in the basic research of science and biology and chemistry, pushing out the boundaries of all of these fields where the best innovators could come along and pluck them off and turn them into new companies. We had the most, in the last 50 years, we had the best immigration policy that attracted the best minds and the most energetic people from all over the world to enrich our society and again, start so many new things. And lastly, we had the best rules. That is, we had the right rules and regulations that incentivize risk-taking, because you need that, but prevented recklessness. And what we argue is that five-part formula, Tom, by the way, which goes back deep into our history. Think of Lincoln during the Civil War, what he did. Mm-hmm. Built the National Railroad, connecting the Atlantic to the Pacific. Started the National Academy of Science. Passed the Morrell Act that created all the land-grant universities. Yep. So we've been working on this formula for a long time, and our argument is in the last couple of decades, we've really let it slip.
Do you see evidence that fraying in this country of that package, of that system and the success it created, evidence that fraying is contributing to disorder in the world, Tom?
I think that would be a stretch. But I don't go there in that column or in our book, but I do believe that the opposite certainly is true. In other words, I can't prove what you said, but I do firmly believe that a strong America that is at its best and that is working on all five of those pillars is simply a great model and example to other countries that they will be inspired to follow.
You say,
and when
so
we're not when we're not doing that, we leave the field open for a lot of other alternatives, or none at all.
Yeah, you're right. With so many societies around the world being torn apart, especially in the Middle East, it is vital that America survives and flourishes as a beacon of pluralism. I mean, that seems to suggest that people watch the signal at all times, and they may be watching it now. If it's strong, it's one thing. If it's not, it's another.
Yeah, people do watch us for better and for worse, but they do, and we are an example for a lot of people. And at the end of the when the West, when democratic values triumphed in the Cold War, that had an effect all over the world. That did inspire people, and when we're drifting, it makes it easier for other people to drift. When we're playing small ball, then other people play small ball.
Okay, let's go to what you describe here as pretty big ball. Let's bring in the silver bullet. And I say that with a little tongue-in-cheek. I know you're not saying it really solves everything under the sun. But it's a long list of things. It's a profound list of things that you say a carbon tax could help us address. Give us the outline.
So, Tom, what I really believe is we've been at this budget debate for so long now, it feels like for at least 4 years, that we've almost forgot the plot. You know, like, what is it we're trying to do?
Yeah.
And so part of that column was to say, well, what we're trying to do is actually, you know, make the country strong again. Now, the budget debate seems to me to be totally deadlocked because basically we don't have enough cash on the table here. And so each side wants to take it out of the other. So Republicans say, well, just get it from cutting the social safety net that so many people depend on and more will in the future. And Democrats say, well, just keep taxing rich people or corporations. And neither side, because we have this sort of political stalemate, is going to be able to impose that on the other. And so what I'm looking for is an alternative source of revenue raised in the least painful way possible that would in effect allow produce a pile of cash that would allow both sides to get a lot of what they want. It would allow Republicans to say, okay, if you pass a carbon tax of $20 to $25 a ton, it would raise about $1 to $1.2 trillion. Depends on a lot of factors. Mm-hmm. We can talk about that later. Now, Republicans,
over
by the way,
over the next decade, you're saying?
Over 10 years.
That's a lot of money.
That's a lot of money. Now, you have to understand, the idea of a carbon tax, in many ways, has been a Republican idea or is certainly promoted by many Republican economists like Greg Mankiw at Harvard or Gary Becker at the University of Chicago, Becker, Nobel Prize winning economist, George Shultz, former Secretary of State out of Stanford. Now, what they want is a carbon tax that's revenue neutral. They say, let's raise that $1.2 trillion and then let's return it to people either in the form of a rebate, a check you get every week or every month, excuse me, or every year, or let's use it to offset your personal income tax, your payroll tax, and corporate taxes by the same amount. They're afraid to give that money to the government, okay?
They don't want a bigger government. They say, don't feed that beast anymore.
Don't feed that beast. But what they do say is, can we please stop taxing more of what we want, which is work and corporate investment, and let's start taxing more of what we don't want, which is carbon pollution in the atmosphere. And this has a long history and tradition. Now, what I say is, let's split the difference. Let's take half that money, if we could, and let's apply it to lowering everyone's, you know, rich, poor, or middle class, their personal income taxes and corporate taxes. And let's use part of the other half to invest in the sources of our strength, and another part to pay down the deficit and offset maybe what we have to do on Social Security and Medicare right now.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with New York Times columnist Tom Friedman about how to, he says, maybe save America. He says a carbon tax on gas, on oil, on coal might be the way to do it. The silver bullet that breaks open a bright new future. Big answer. Lots of resistance out there to it, but big problems on the table that he says it could address. You can join us this hour. Does this argument get through to you? Do you see Tom Friedman's point? Do you buy it? Could this be the magic bullet to balance our books, rebuild our infrastructure, refuel our economy, bring America back, and save the planet? Does this sound wrong to you? Too expensive? Too hard on the family van at the gas pump? On American business? Have you got a better idea? 800-423-8255 is our number. 800-423-TALK. Tom Friedman joins us today from Washington. Tom, you know, we've got people online here, some applauding and others saying, wait a minute, that's really going to bite. I mean, you say in your column, you're talking about more dimes and quarters that would come with this tax for every gallon of gasoline or hour of electricity. And people say, that's going to hurt. That's going to hurt a lot of people. What do you do about that?
Well, first of all, it's not free, and as I said in the column, it's not painless. But on the people who would be most harmed by it, the poor, people living below the poverty line, there are any number of ways to rebate the cost and to cushion them from the burden of the tax. And the economists have a panoply of suggestions on that. No one believes it's very hard to do.
You mean rebate the cost? So somehow what we take this tax, we carve out a piece of it and ship it back to people beneath a certain income level?
Right. You give them a rebate at the end of the year. There are any number of suggestions on that, but they're certainly – we can easily cushion the poorest of the poor on this.
Okay. And what about the – do we grow the government with this or do we keep it revenue neutral? Where do you come down on that?
So I'm very much on not growing the government or keeping it revenue neutral. I'm on using the money for really important investments in things not only that we need now, Tom, but have historically been the engines of our growth. Using it to build infrastructure, maybe wiring the country with high-speed bandwidth, something that we know would leverage enormous amount of innovation and commerce. Using it to fund NIH and all our great national laboratories and research that would we know have spun off so many great technologies that have been turned into differentiated companies. Those are the things that I would spend it on. But I would also spend it, frankly, on Pell Grants, more grants to make sure as many people in this country who want access to some form of post-secondary education can get it. I think that's just vital in the 21st century. That's what I would spend it on. And I don't see that as waste, fraud, and abuse.
Not everyone, of course, is going to see that as not growing government. You've got a large...
Well, all those systems exist right now, and there are ways to do it by incentivizing the private sector.
Right. The climate side of this, which you've also been talking about, writing about for a long time, what would it do on the alternative energy side, on the climate side? What's your hope?
Look, you know, number of countries all over the world have carbon taxes. Australia has one. Great Britain has one. China has announced plans to go in that direction this year. Obviously, until and unless everyone, you know, has some form of restraining their carbon because it's a global problem, what we do can only be a drop in the bucket. To me, it's most important for having this effect. Even if we're—and by the way, I call for it to be phased in very gradually, mm-hmm. Over a decade or more. To me, the impact would be this. It would be a signal to every CEO in the country. Okay, they just passed a carbon tax. What is our policy? What are we going to do? Get me a chief sustainability officer. In other words, I think it would actually trigger in terms of reaction by changing kind of the mindset of the country so much more than the actual cost would be. There's examples of this I know in other areas. And so number one, and for me the most important thing, it would trigger, I believe, an enormous amount of innovation in clean tech and clean energy, which I think is really important when we've got this natural gas boon going on. A wonderful thing, by the way, natural gas emits about half the carbon of coal, but we don't want natural gas to be a dead end. We want it to be a bridge to a clean energy future. And so I think for all these reasons, a carbon tax, and here there's, again, a lot of Republican economists who I can cite in support of it, would really stimulate the kind of innovation and force us to pay the real cost of some of the dirty fuels that we're now consuming.
I want to look at how some of that innovation might play out, the economics of that. Let's take on some of the pushback against this, Tom.
Please.
I've got a little tape here. This is Peter Huntsman. This is the brother of the former Republican presidential candidate, John Huntsman, CEO of Huntsman Corporation, big chemical manufacturer. He's talking with Fox Business's Neil Cavuto, this is last fall, saying he, Peter Huntsman, is against a carbon tax.
You're talking about $1 trillion over a 10-year period. $1 trillion. Neil, that's almost $2 billion a week. That's a transference of wealth that's coming out of the American consumer. And I'm not really sure if anybody really knows where this money is going, what it is intended to do, or how it really cleans up the environment.
Tom Friedman, what do you say?
Well, two things. Consider the source.
Chemical business, no doubt. Plenty of petrochemicals in those clam boxes for hamburgers.
And number one, and again, part of it, I'd simply cite people like George Shultz. Part of it, we can make revenue neutral. Listen, if I had to settle for all of it being revenue neutral, I would, because on balance, I think it's going to tilt us economically toward the kind of investments that will make for a cleaner planet and a cleaner America. Look, he talks about the $2 billion transfer. Well, what he doesn't cite is childhood asthma rates in New York City and what's happened to them over the last decade or in any of our major urban areas. So
which you're tying to fossil fuels.
Right, exactly. So, you can pluck whatever number you want out here. In the history of innovation, Tom, one of the things that's really been apparent, and if you go back to the catalytic converter, remember that?
Mm-hmm,
I don't know how old
sure.
you are, but
mm-hmm.
remember when the auto industry, we decided had to
clean up
the emissions, had to install mm-hmm. catalytic. If you go back and read what Lee Iacocca said at the time, the catalytic converter would be the end of Western civilization as we know it. He predicted basically, this was going to cost so much for the auto industry. I don't remember the details. They're in my book, Hot, Flat, and Crowded, but I think that everyone would go bankrupt. The sun wouldn't rise, the rivers would turn backward if we imposed a catalytic converter on the auto industry. Guess what happened? Not only did we do it, not only did we do it faster and cheaper than any of these guys predicted, but it drove a whole set of other innovations and created, by the way, spun off new industries, which we were then, and new products, which we were able to then sell to the rest of the world.
So you're saying...
So I don't buy these scare theories at all.
You can rebate a bunch of this to those who would be hit by it. You're saying that we can bring these innovations in. We've still got questions here on competitiveness. Listener says, Jeff, Tom, says, what an awful idea. I can't think of anything that would do more to stifle business, cause businesses to leave the country, destroy industries. And here's Peter Huntsman, John Huntsman's brother, one more time. He's the head of a big chemical company. But here's him talking on Fox about how this carbon tax would disadvantage, he says, U.S. business.
If something like this is passed, it really needs to be on a global basis. The Indians, the Chinese, Europeans, the Americans.
Yeah, because my worry would be if the Chinese get a pass, if the Indians get a pass, and it's all left to guys like you, we're the ones at the disadvantage.
We're the ones at the disadvantage. And companies like ours that are international, we've got options.
Okay, if America does this and the rest of the world doesn't, our companies are disadvantaged and we're in competitive trouble, Tom. What do you say? Peter Huntsman there.
Well, first of all, as I said, China's announced plans. They haven't laid out the details yet to impose a carbon tax on their own companies because they can't breathe anymore, number one. Number two, I have one word for Mr. Huntsman, Denmark. Denmark has the highest carbon and energy taxes of any country in the world. And little Denmark leads the world on a per capita basis. I'm pretty sure this is true, but it's certainly very high up, if not, in global energy companies. Whether it's Novozymes, their biotechnology energy company, Danesco, or their wind turbine companies, their incredibly efficient waste to energy companies. Why is that? Because what happened for little Denmark? Oh my God! They should if this guy's argument was true, Denmark should be bankrupt today. Little Denmark, how can they compete in the world at their cost structure with their wages, with their unions? Well, guess what happened? These energy taxes forced their companies to become incredibly efficient. And when they became that efficient, they discovered because the rest of the world has these same problems, they suddenly had exportable global industries. So, clean energy exports are not a small percentage of little Denmark's exports today. So I just don't buy it at all.
Tom Friedman says, let's go big with the carbon tax, use it to balance the books and leverage a lot of change. Really, it is fascinating how right down the middle the reaction here is online. Let's go on air. Paul in Columbia, South Carolina, you're on the air with Tom Friedman. What do you think, Paul?
Hi, how are you? I have 2 points, and I'll be quick and concise. First of all, no matter how you couch the redistribution of the, and I never thought I would agree with Mr. Huntsman or anyone on Fox, no matter how you couch the redistribution of the funds that come in from a carbon tax, it's not going to pass. I mean, it's just not realistic to think that we can raise any taxes in the current climate. Secondly, I think this winds up acting as a broad-based that. Almost everything in our economy is made with carbon, carbon-based power.
Yep.
And how is everyone going to make the changeover? How is this going to change anything? So
you mean how do they make it technically, Paul, on the factory floor? Is that what you mean?
I'm sorry?
How do they make the changeover technically, mechanically on the factory floor?
Sure, technically. Just because you add 25 cents to the production of almost everything in our economy, including gasoline, pipes, everything, it's just going to get passed along to the consumer. They're not going to say, uh-oh, we better get nuclear power, or we better become more efficient.
Paul, in South Carolina, let us pick it up. Tom Friedman, hold the political piece for a moment, though it is a huge one. But what about just the practical side of this? Paul's got an interesting point there. You know how fossil fuel dependent our economy, our manufacturing, everything else is. You put this in place, and maybe it's just a vet. Maybe it doesn't change all that. Maybe it's too complicated, too embedded to change that.
Well, it's a very legitimate question from Paul, and I would simply say a couple of things. One is, and I thought about this in writing the column, personally, we probably need a vet. Let's just start here. We need a new source of income, okay? We got to generate it somehow. If you can get it from all from rich people, God bless you. If you think you're going to get it by cutting Social Security and Medicare, I want to see that. But something's got to give here. So that's where I start. Now, some people actually think we do need a consumption tax, a national sales tax. That's one route. I'd be happy. I'd be much happier if we could get it by taxing bullets and guns out the wazoo. But it seems to me carbon is the most likely one because of the multiple benefits you get. Not that you wouldn't get it from bullets and guns too, but. With a carbon tax, there's so many ways to do it. You can do it by just focusing on power plants, and that would affect electricity rates. And Paul is right; that will cascade, through the economy. What you cannot predict, and what he can't predict, and here's where I would disagree with Paul, is the innovative effects. Just as an aside, Tom, I spent yesterday at HAS, Health and Human Services, okay. HHS, yeah. Mm-hmm. I really am not – one thing you and I have never talked about is the health care bill, Obamacare, yeah. The American –
No, we haven't.
The Health Care Act.
Affordable Care Act, Obamacare.
And to the extent I focused on it, to me it was all about access. We're going to give more people insurance and we're going to insure them this way. And, oh, by the way, over on the side – we're going to try a few pilot projects for innovations around electronic health records and healthcare data and whatnot. And that was kind of my sort of understanding of it. So I met yesterday at HHS with a group of healthcare startups, all of which have been triggered by the Obamacare Act. It is massive. There's been a massive explosion in healthcare data management, information management. Companies triggered by the Obamacare Act. And it may, in time, we may look back at Obamacare. And by the way, I don't know how it's going to work out, and I'm not an expert on that at all. But it may be as important for the innovation it triggers in health data, in health records that are cost-saving as it is on the access side. And so what I don't buy is when people say, you're just going to do this carbon tax and it's not going to have any effect and no one will do anything in response. I really disagree with that.
Mm. Let's get a call from Ithaca, New York, if we can here. We've got Carl calling in. Carl, hi. Carl, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I kind of see this idea in as part of a bigger program. I think it has to be couched in a huge sort of publicity. What Lee Iacocca said is representative of business. They're there to make money for themselves. I hate to be that extreme, but I think as a society, we've become middle-aged, complacent. We've gone from, hey, let's try this, from can-do to if it ain't broke, don't fix it. That's exactly what Iacocca said in so many words, And obviously it is broke. The automobile industry has come along. And I always knew they were capable, but from the back in the 70s and 80s, and we knew we had a problem, they did everything they could to buy Congress along with the oil industry and suppress anything. And it's finally come out, obviously, 20, 30 years late, that we can do better with, with fuel. So I kind of just want to say, and I'll get off the air, that this needs to be couched in quite a campaign. And as an example, when the BP thing happened and all these oil sort of dependent senators were fighting Obama, the Massey Energy mine collapse happened, killed 29 people. It got knocked off the radar by BP.
Yeah, we've got a lot. There's a long record. Hey, Carl, let us pick it up before the break here. Tom, what about this basic idea? We don't do big change like this. It's just not where we are anymore as a country.
Well, I agree with everything Carl just said, including and the. Okay, which is really, one of my points that, and one of my major points is that, Tom, we've become so used to our politics being paralyzed that we don't even ask big questions anymore. And so we are so used to just settling for the worst suboptimal compromise negotiated at the 11th hour with no due diligence that we now think that is normal. And when you do that time and time again, year after year, you end up with a suboptimal country. And as Carl said, what this needs, and all your other callers, they have very legitimate points. I'm struggling with this myself. So I don't think it's like, this is a silver bullet or whatnot, a nice introduction, but that's not how I'm presenting it, But I'm just saying we have these problems. We have these potential solutions. Let's go for something big. And the president needs to be out there and sell it, educate people, make the connections. And please don't tell me it's on the White House website, okay?
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with New York Times columnist Tom Friedman about how maybe to save America, he says, a carbon tax on gas, on oil, on coal. Lots of feedback online. Tom, DJ says, yes, yes, should have done it 10 years ago. But David says, why does everyone think a new tax will help the country? The real problem is how much money the average household makes. And I wondered, Tom, just to play this for you, to begin to get to the politics of this. Here's the president. This was after his election last November, saying he would address climate change, but not at the expense of the economy and jobs. Here's Obama.
I think the American people right now have been so focused and will continue to be focused on our economy and jobs and growth that, you know, if the message is somehow we're going to ignore jobs and growth simply to address climate change, I don't think anybody's going to go for that. I won't go for that.
The president, yes, we want to act on climate change. No, we won't hurt the economy. And I'm sure you remember this, Tom, but Jay Carney, White House spokesman, saying right around the same time, quoting him here, exact words, we would never propose a carbon tax and have no intention of proposing one. If it's such a good idea, why not even a newly reelected Democratic president doing it or going there, Tom?
Well. So where do I start? There was a superstorm that hit the Northeast, you call them, last year, Storm Sandy. And we had to pay for the cleanup, we as a country. And that's what we do for our brothers and sisters. We help them wherever the crisis hits. The total cleanup bill was, exactly $60 billion. That was exactly what the Senate and House approved and the president signed. At the same time, the exact same time, President Obama rammed through his preferred tax, a tax on high-income earners, top 2% of the population. Yep. It was going to raise $600 billion over 10 years. In other words, $60 billion a year. Oh, let's see. What does that mean, Tom? That means that the entire tax increase that President Obama passed this year went to paying for the reconstruction of one storm. Okay? Mm-hmm. So $60 billion bill for Sandy, $60 billion in income tax increase by Obama. So it's what I call small ball. And, you really have a choice because you can say we're not going to increase this on him and we're not going to increase this on her. And look at me. I'm standing up to defend the American people. But Obama just came out now and said we're going to change the Social Security calculator for cost of living, which is going to, in effect, be a tax on your Social Security. So which do you want? I mean, do you want to retire later, retire with less, or get everybody to pay a little bit more over time so we can do a lot more things and also – by the way, create jobs with this. The idea that a carbon tax is only a job killer is simply defied by the examples of all these other countries that have implemented it. So, look, if that's the game Obama wants to play, then that's great. And I can't wait to visit the section in the Obama Library about big ideas that I thought of doing but never did. That's going to be a big room, Tom.
Tom Friedman. A couple of calls here. Tommy in Nashville, Tennessee. Tommy, you're on the air.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
It sounds to me like it's just a gimmick to get more taxes. I mean, fuel's as high now as it's ever been, and there comes a time you got to quit taxing and start watching what you spend. They're going to have to be accountable. We can't just keep paying more and more taxes all the time.
And what if we don't have enough to pay for what we already owe, Tommy? What do we do?
We do without. That's what I do when I can afford something. We got to start doing the same thing. The American people are doing without right now. And I'm a truck driver. I work every day. But if I ain't got the money, I don't buy it. That's just what – and America needs to start doing the same thing. Our government needs to start doing the same thing.
Tommy, we got it. Tom Friedman, Tommy takes his truck to the gas pump. He sees what it costs. It's high already. More doesn't sound good to him.
Well, first of all, a carbon tax could easily be phased in, 5-10 cents a gallon over several years. You know, Tom, I live out in Bethesda, Maryland. I drive into work every day. You know what I notice when I drive in? The variation in gas prices of 5 or 10 cents just from one gas station to the next. And so I believe that, this could be phased in ways that would not actually be that noticeable to people, number one. And number two, I had the pleasure of chatting with Ben Bernanke, the head of the Federal Reserve, a few weeks ago, and we were talking about just phase-in things, you know, and he pointed out to me something, and he was not endorsing anything, so don't get me wrong here, but we were just talking about how to phase things in. He said, you know, back in the 80s, there was the Greenspan Commission on Social Security Reform. Do you realize some of the reforms that the Greenspan Commission on Social Security Reform decided on then are still being phased in today?
Your point is this would come in slowly. So
you could come in slowly.
You're not going to make $1 trillion if you bring in a decade if you come in slowly.
Well, you know, again, it depends how slowly, up front, up back, whatever. And by the way, $1 trillion would be my goal. I'd settle for half, okay? You know, I'm also a realist. And to Tommy's point also, you know, and I know where he's coming from, and it's, I think, a sincere sentiment. But, you know, it reminds me of a story Bob Inglis told me. Bob was a congressman from South Carolina who was defeated in the by a Tea Party insurgent in the 2 years ago in the midterm election, and he is famous for speaking at a town hall meeting in a small South Carolina town, and a constituent stood up, wagged his finger at him, and said, "Keep your government hands off my Medicare." You know, a lot of people think Medicare is some entitlement that comes from, I don't know, Mars or from the ground or the heavens. You know, keep your government hands off my Medicare. So all I'm trying to say is, you know, I think we have to make choices here. You can grow without a plan, Tom, but you better not cut without a plan. You cut without a plan, you can hit bones, arteries, you know, you can really do damage. When I look at the sequester, that to me is cutting without a plan. And all I'm trying to say is I think we need a grand bargain. I think it would be a huge lift for the country. I think we need to invest, cut, and tax, as Tommy says. But I think we need to do all three. And somehow we got to do it in the least painful, most intelligent way possible. So I've thrown out a carbon tax idea. If somebody's got a better idea, please let me know. But what we're doing if we don't do that, Tom, is we're in effect taunting the two most powerful forces on the planet, the market and Mother Nature at the same time. We're basically saying to both of them, what you got, babe? What you got? Mother Nature, all you got is one little centigrade. Right? That's all you've got? Oh, I'm not afraid. What do you got, Mr. Market? No interest rate rise. Or interest rates, what you – well, you know, we could wake up one day, Tom, and discover what they got, you know. And that's what I'm trying to forestall.
And be flat on our back. Joe, in Iowa City, Iowa, you're on the air with Tom Friedman.
Hey, Mr. Friedman, I think you're right on with this carbon tax. What you're proposing is just what the country needs, and basically it's just to pay for the externality that's created by burning carbon-based fuels. So all you're proposing and what we all need to do is just clean up after ourselves. And if we make garbage, then we should be responsible for the cost of removing that garbage from the system. And you're absolutely right on with all the jobs that it can create. And so it doesn't seem like anybody's made a really great story for why the carbon tax is so critically important. And Tommy, the caller before, the truck driver, yeah, I agree. People don't want to pay more, but we have to look at the reality of competing long term as well. And the solution for the country and the economy trying to just go with cheap energy, cheap energy, cheap energy is going to really hurt us eventually in the long run, because as the other world economies deal with this, they're going to be in a more competitive situation. I mean, I remember when the catalytic converters, everyone was crying about that too. And what our auto companies were in a position when all they had were pickup trucks and big SUVs, and then when gas spiked, whatever, 6-8 years ago,
they were in trouble.
Were in a non-competitive position.
Joe, we've got it. I appreciate your call. There's a shout out to you, Tom. Let's get another here. Liz in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Liz, you're on the air.
Thanks. Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'd like to ask Tom Friedman how he thinks Congress will pass this wonderful carbon tax legislation now that Citizens United allows unlimited amounts of corporate money to flow into American elections at the local, state, and national levels.
Well, Liz, your presumption there that would push hammer and tongs against this legislation.
You can't get legislation. I believe you can't get any environmental legislation passed if Congress is controlled by corporate money.
Tom Friedman?
Liz raises a very important point. I'd say, just to lift her spirits a little bit, two things. One, California has managed to pass some amazing carbon and climate legislation and clean energy legislation, despite massive gobs of money from fossil fuel industries, because it turned out they've also got a rising green industry there that was able to fight back, and a lot of concerned citizens, number one. You raise a very legitimate point, but I'm a big believer in the bully pulpit of the presidency, not the magic of it, but if we start simply having a different conversation in this country, you have no idea what you'll catalyze. Look how many young people came out to elect President Obama for the first time, and think about the money that was arrayed against him in that election. So, nothing ventured, nothing gained. If we shrink all our aspirations to fit what we think is the sort of, we can't do anything more in this country, then we'll shrink ourselves.
Let's go to Bill in Watertown, Connecticut. Bill, you're on with Tom Friedman.
Hi, I just wanted to make a point. I think it would be foolish to think that the Chinese would gladly comply. It seems as though they've been making huge investments over the last 30 years into oil and all other energy sources, precious metals and so forth. And for them to just gladly lay down, we'd have to put a lot more thought into that.
You don't think they would follow this path? They wouldn't go with measures to cut back on fossil fuel consumption there, I guess, is your point, Bill. Is that right?
No, my point is this. Like I said, they've been investing in oil. They're in Africa big time.
So what? Where
President Obama wouldn't allow us to drill off of Florida, they've come in with the Cubans, and they plan on a cooperative effort to take the oil from outside the Florida basin and use it there.
Bill, I think we got it. Let us go with that. Tom Friedman, okay, we could do this, but the Chinese aren't going to go there, asserts Bill. So what?
Well, two things, Bill. One is I'd urge you to Google China and carbon tax, number one. Two, I'd urge you to Google China and auto mileage standards. And see the kind of auto mileage standards the Chinese have been imposing on their own car industry. And three, I'd urge you to Google pictures of weather today in Beijing, because in the last month, the pollution in Beijing has been so bad. There have been so many sick people as a result. Chinese simply cannot breathe. And I don't believe that this model of – by the way, the Chinese are doing a lot of everything because of the energy they need. So, yes, they're doing a lot of oil. They're doing a lot of carbon. They're doing a lot of nuclear. And they're doing a huge amount of green. The reason, if you go out to buy a solar panel today, the price is so low is because the Chinese have been making so many for themselves, and they're doing to solar panels what they did to tennis shoes. So I think when we lead, others follow. China is not going to be able to sustain the kind of path they're on right now. When every Chinese can afford a car, they will simply choke to death.
Tom, go big again here. I mean, I don't know if this is the right way or not, but I definitely resonate with your assertion here that we've got to be able to think big and act big, or we're dead on arrival. If we think every big idea is dead on arrival, so are we, you write. And just getting out of that box, that kind of triage box, last minute, just some slapdash temporary solution to everything. One way or another, we've got to get out of it. But I think a lot of people have lost confidence that even if you hand this money over to the government, they're going to do something so positive with it. There's a lot of skepticism always going to be poured into some unfunded pension tank, or it's going to, it's just going to disappear down some, what Jesse Helms used to say, rat hole. How do you get past that to get out into that's kind of American dynamic of, hey, we're doing big things, they're working, this is great, let's go.
It's a huge point. It's what we wrote about in the last book. And let me just step back for a second and say this. One of the things that's always troubled me about the Obama presidency is that it's got no narrative. I don't know what it's about. It's a collection of different initiatives, and I thought you saw it in his inaugural address and in his first State of the Union. It's just a lot of little things taken together. That's not to discount healthcare. I think that was a hugely important thing. I'd love to see him do the same in the energy field. So, what should the vision of America be today? Well, I mean, to me, the organizing vision should be this: I would like to see America today be to the world what Cape Canaveral was to America back in the 1960s. What was it? Cape Canaveral was the place, the later Kennedy Space Center, where we launched our one moonshot. That was our big national project. We're not going to have one big national project anymore. What I want America to be, it to be the platform where everyone in the world wants to come and launch their moonshot, where every American and everybody else out there wants to come to start something, some business, some NGO, some idea, some group, some organization, and they want to come here because we have the best education, the best infrastructure, the best patent rules, the best rule of law, the most government-funded research, the cleanest environment. And if we can make America that platform where everyone wants to launch something, okay, I promise you there will be jobs out there for everybody, you know, across the educational spectrum. That's, the, to me, the organizing principle, and how we get that launching pad seems to be, to me, what our politics should be about today.
The urgency,
not balancing the budget.
Well,
you know?
I mean, that's a piece of it, but the urgency in your voice says we don't have forever to do that.
We don't have forever because Mother Nature and you know, Mother Nature is just sitting out there, and we can talk whatever we want. Tom, the president can say whatever he wants. But Mother Nature, as my teacher, Tom, Rob Watson, always likes to say, she's just chemistry, biology, and physics. That's all she is. You can't tweet talk her. You can't talk her up. You can't talk her down. Can't say Mother Nature, we're having a recession. Could you take a year off? Mother Nature always bats last, and she always bats 1,000. Do not mess with Mother Nature.
Not to mention the markets in their turn, and as you have written, the events of this last week show if we want to keep that beacon of, what, pluralism up there, you've got to keep the light tower strong.
You better believe it.
Tom Friedman, it's interesting online. A lot of pushback, but people thinking about America's big circumstances, and we are glad that you are too. Thank you so much for joining us today.
Pleasure, Tom, as always.
New York Times' Tom Friedman is From Beirut to Jerusalem is out in extended edition. Listeners, thanks for joining us today. Tomorrow, Super Attorney Alan Dershowitz on terror, American law, the Boston bombing. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.